Stay tuned for Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah, featuring two film critics with distinctly different tastes in movies, Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. He thinks her tastes are shallow. She thinks his are pretentious. Listen in as they discuss and debate new releases and other film-related topics. Let the clash begin.
Hello and welcome to the Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net.
Hannah, I bought the wine tonight, and it's a little risque, I believe. It's a little risque.
It's an El Burro Kick-Ass Garnacha. It's a product of Spain. So I'm assuming it has to do with the kick-ass. And if I had to guess or ascribe that to one of these films, I would say maybe you were referring to Notorious RBG in The Basis of Sex.
You're actually way off.
I am?
Yeah.
Because she's kick-ass.
It's about the burro part.
Oh. Burro. What's so I'm like looking at the wrong part of the label.
What's another name for burro?
I don't know. What is it? Like a horse or a bull?
Burro is Spanish for donkey.
Donkey.
What's another name for donkey?
Oh, so like the Veep? So it's about Vice and Dick Cheney, perhaps.
So, Our biggest film of the week is we're going to talk about Vice, Adam McKay's Vice, and what Vice means is Vice President Dick Cheney. So when I saw El Burro, I was like, oh, Jackass.
Oh, see, that's so funny, though. You saw Jackass, I saw Kick-Ass and thought of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Ah. So I think it'll be interesting that we kind of are talking about both of those films tonight.
Well, if you remember, I think it was 2 years ago, The Big Short made my top 10 list. I think it was actually number 10. I was blown away by just the originality and creativity of Adam McKay, who had these really famous people like Margot Robbie and Selena Gomez just stare at you in the camera and tell you about derivative trading and Steve Carell and just about how the financial crisis came to be. And it was such a unique feature. It just knocked me off my feet. Well, he did it again. He's back, and he's studying Dick Cheney, and he brought a character with him, an actor with him from The Big Short, Christian Bale. And you don't recognize Christian Bale. I didn't recognize Christian Bale a lot. As Dick, he looks exactly like Dick Cheney. However, this, I don't know if this is a case of too much. He did it again, and it didn't work the second time around.
Too soon, perhaps?
Maybe it is, maybe it isn't too soon. Everybody already has an opinion on Dick Cheney. You're either on that end of the spectrum that is, you know, country right or wrong. He's the vice president. Or you're on the other end of the spectrum going, that man got us into a war and changed millions of lives needlessly for a thirst for power, for a taste of executive power. So it's a biopic, but not. It's a think piece, but not. And it's funny. It tries to be funny. And it goes, you know, it does go out of order, but somewhat chronologically. We do start with a younger Dick Cheney and a younger Lynn Cheney. The family is involved here, and it ends sort of, you know, present day, 5, 10 years ago when he kind of fell out of the spotlight when he basically retired after the vice presidency. Vice has already been nominated for 6 Golden Globe Awards, Best Picture, Directing, and 4 Acting Awards. I am not on the Vice bandwagon, Hannah, and I wonder, and I'm not alone in that. This is a very polarizing film. There are acolytes who think it's another genius work of Adam McKay, and there are those who just are left cold, and I believe I was left somewhat cold.
I was too, and for me this was a case of we're in the midst of probably one of the most divisive political eras of our time. And this is something that just reminds you of one of the other most divisive political moments of our time. And I'm like, I was not in the mood to be dragged back into that time frame and into that world. And this is almost, it plays like it's a mockumentary. It's if you dramatized one of these Michael Moore documentaries, that's almost what this feels like. It pulls no punches. This is anti-Dick Cheney. This is Dick Cheney as evil incarnate. And it shows George W as a total bumpkin who got the wool pulled over his eyes and allowed himself to have this vice president that was going to wield the most power of any vice president in U.S. history. And so it left me cold because it left me just bereft and depressed. And I was like, this is just not a Christmas movie by any stretch. And maybe in 2020, I might be interested in seeing this film again. But right now, I did not enjoy it. Christian Bale, I love. I've loved Christian Bale ever since, you know, like The Fighter, and he's great in American Hustle. And he definitely is one of those actors who embodies the character that he's playing. And he does so in a prosthetically perfect way, this imitation of Dick Cheney. He's brilliant in it, but I did not like the film.
Adam McKay started out as a writer on Saturday Night Live, and then he became the head writer. He was that good. Then he started writing movies. He wrote Anchorman. He created mm-hmm. Ron Burgundy. Mm-hmm. He created Ricky Bobby in Talladega Nights. And what a lot of people didn't realize, wow, those are very funny movies, hysterical movies, which invaded our pop culture still today. People quote those films all the time. He was making fun of them.
Right.
He was making – a lot of people don't realize he's making fun of the Ricky Bobbies of the world and the Ron Burgundies of the world. And people just think they're funny, but he's actually – it's a send-up. And then he discovered a niche in The Big Short, and it went over so well that he tried it again. And it's actually a little – Derivative Training was hard. It was really complicated, and he did his best to explain it to the layman. And now he's doing it again with things like the unitary executive theory, which is the president is, you know, he can't do anything illegal. He's above the law. That was Dick Cheney's view. And he even starts out with a disclaimer, saying Dick Cheney was one of the most secretive leaders in history, so I had to fill in a lot of blanks. And he gets cute. At the end of the second act of the film, the credits roll. And he's like, this is how history could have ended. There was no Iraq war because Bush v. Gore in the Supreme Court wasn't decided that way, and 500 votes in Florida went the other way.
Right.
And the credits rolled. He's like, oh, just kidding. And then this happened.
It was very funny. I mean, that was actually a very funny moment because you're like, wait a minute, aren't we only like 15 minutes into this film? but it's harsh. It's harsh. I mean, there are moments in this film where that what if scenario – when it's almost like, God, this guy won't die. I mean, throughout the entire film, it's like, you know, he's got another heart attack. And it's just, you really have to be on, it's preaching to the choir for the most part. So anybody who is at all a fan of Dick Cheney would just be horrified, I think, by this film. And I do think it's harmed by coming out so close in the aftermath, and of course nobody would have predicted this, but the death of George Herbert Walker Bush and the all the accolades and the commentary and seeing Dick Cheney just coming out to talk about his friend and seeing him on the air for the first time in a long time right before this film came out, I think hurts it a bit because you sort of feel like, I think, a little more empathy for him and for W than you might have 6 months ago.
You know who really comes off surprisingly horrible in this film is Lynn Cheney. Amy Adams is Lynn Cheney. She's not necessarily Lady Macbeth, but the illusion is more than there. When they're deciding whether or not he should actually run for vice president, they actually recite Macbeth. They're laying in bed. And they're talking Macbeth, and you know, Adam McKay saying no one can really know the conversation between Dick and Lynn, so I'm going to imagine it as Macbeth. And you know, she says stuff like when they're on the campaign trail, those liberal snobs want you to lose your jobs to affirmative action, and you know she believes it. And what they do to their daughter Mary Cheney is mm-hmm. heartbreaking. Now I can only imagine that's how it happened. I have no idea that's how it happened, but heartbreaking is what that happens. And so Christian Bale got nominated. Amy Adams got nominated. I don't think Amy will for the Oscars. Christian might. And Sam Rockwell, he's the one who picked up a supporting actor nomination as W, the clueless W. And he's hardly in the film. And I actually nominated a different supporting actor for one of my DC film critic votes. I nominated Steve Carell as Donald Rumsfeld. I thought he was much better. He's smarmy. There's this wicked good old boy snark that he has throughout the film, which I just thought was, he knocked it out of the park.
I thought he was very good in it, but I certainly wouldn't have thought he was in it enough to really be
He's in it way more than Sam Rockwell.
No, I don't think either one of them really has a strong enough role to be a supporting, to win the supporting actor. I love Sam Rockwell, so don't get me wrong. He's always managed to really make the most of these character roles that he does play. And so I was happy to see him in that role as Rummy. I mean, Tyler Perry as Colin Powell, I think, was a bit of a distraction almost. Adam McKay gets some great people. It's a good ensemble.
Well, Lisa Gay Hamilton was just, I thought that was Condoleezza Rice.
yes, that was spot on too.
Good Lord.
Yeah, and I mean, there is no doubt that you watch this. I was looking forward to seeing it because I remember just seeing those initial trailers and seeing that resemblance. You're like, how can that be Christian Bale underneath all of that makeup? And he, you know, as he tends to do, he gained what he needed to gain for the role, like 40 pounds.
He's a method actor.
He is a total method actor, and he's so good. And so this is absolutely a case where, you know, kudos to the performances, but I felt the film overall was a misfire.
I agree. I'm just not a big fan of this film at all. Our next film actually has higher critical praise than Vice does. If Beale Street Could Talk, and we're talking Barry Jenkins. Barry Jenkins is somewhat still off fresh from a Best Director Oscar and a Best Picture Oscar with Moonlight. I still remember him running on stage when they realized Moonlight won and it wasn't La La Land.
I'm still upset about that, although I did like Moonlight.
And we're talking James Baldwin. We talked about James Baldwin, again, 2-3 years ago, mm-hmm. when it also made this documentary called I Am Not Your Negro.
Wasn't that just last year?
I think it was 2 years ago. About James Baldwin. It was my favorite documentary of the year. It made my top 10 list. I loved everything about it. And now they took one of James Baldwin's fictional writings, adapted the screenplay for the big screen. Barry Jenkins directed it. So, Hannah, tell me about what's going on with Tish and Fonny. Why are they having problems?
And If Beale Street Could Talk, Tish and Fonny are this black couple who are young black couple who are in love. They've known each other all their lives, and they're getting married. And they live in Harlem in New York in the 1970s. And Fonny ends up getting framed by a bad cop for a rape he did not commit. And then it's really just about the racial and social injustices that are going on in the time. And as Tish's family actually becomes the key champions for Fonny and for trying to gain his freedom. And so it's really, it's a melodramatic kind of film, melancholy. I think you liked it a lot more than I did. I liked it, and it certainly seems to be one of the biggest critical darlings, certainly among the smaller indie type critics groups. But I liked it, and if I hadn't seen the James Baldwin documentary when we did, I think I might not have liked it as much as I did. I think that actually helped. It helped frame the perspective of James Baldwin and his works and where he was coming from in that time frame. So it's the biggest thing that I had to wrap my head around, and I think other people who are just looking at the title are thinking it's Beale Street and that it probably takes place in Memphis. But that's more of a metaphor for this could be any African-American community in the 1970s in the U.S. and possibly in now as well. It's sort of got some timeless themes going on. So to me, it was a bit of a downer, which is why I was not all that thrilled with it. But the performances, again, very good performances.
This is a perfect companion piece to I Am Not Your Negro. I'm glad you brought that up, that actually seeing that makes this stronger. And I agree with you. Knowing and being so familiar with that documentary made this that much stronger. And yeah, I borderline love this film. I do like it a lot more than you. And it's because of the filmmaking, actually. I liked the filmmaking better than the story. Barry Jenkins, he does that documentary style where the camera is right in front of the actor or actress's face. They're staring into the camera saying their dialogue. I think he did that. He did that in Moonlight as well, and I think that works hands down. And also, the color of the film was gorgeous. The score was one of my top five scores by Nicholas Britell. He actually also scored Vice.
But he
was nominated for an Oscar for Moonlight, the Moonlight score, and he does a very similar thing with these tense strings that make things a little bit more suspenseful than they otherwise would be. And just like Moonlight, the supporting actors, with very limited screen time, are so strong. Like Coleman Domingo as Tish's father, Regina King, who's going to win Best Supporting Actress, by the way.
Regina King has one of those. She's just got one of those scenes that screams, oh, supporting actress nomination scene. And she's got one of those in this film.
And even one borderline cameo, but a very strong scene, Brian Tyree Henry. If you watch Atlanta, you know him as the rapper from that show, has a very strong just soliloquy about prison. And I really did like Kiki Layne as Tish. She was wonderful.
And Stephon James is funny. He was very good, too. People might remember him from, like, Selma and
I remember him from
Race.
The Race. Yeah,
from
he played
Race
Jesse Owens.
And so I do like both of them. So, again, I mean, all of the characters, the acting is very good. But this joins a crowd this year of all these other really good films dealing with race relations and civil rights. So this year, I mean, you had Black Klansman, Sorry to Bother You, and my personal favorite, Blindspotting. And so I think, you know, to me, this kind of just fits in the middle of the pack of those. Like, I still like Blindspotting more. But just atmospherically, this one is a good watch, but for the most part overall, I just feel like it could get lost. I mean, we've just been bombarded this year with very similar themed films.
But I don't think it will get lost. Blindspotting got lost.
Blindspotting totally got lost.
This will not get lost. This will, I guarantee you, be nominated for Best Picture. It will win Best Supporting Actress.
Yeah.
It just will. Probably,
I believe that.
It will probably win score. It will probably win adapted screenplay. This will not get lost.
But whether or not it catches fire at the box office, I don't know. I don't know. And how it compares. It'll be interesting to see in the end how it compares to the box office for something, for things like Black Klansman.
No, Black Klansman probably make more money because it's Spike Lee.
It's Spike Lee.
There's a segment of society that says, I'm going to see the new Spike Lee joint.
Yeah, but I think there were a lot of people who were like, I'm going to go see that. You know, there were the indie, a lot of the indie fans who...
Well, plenty of people say, yeah, I'm going to go see the new Barry Jenkins.
The new Barry Jenkins film. And so...
But Rack and Stack, Spike Lee's bigger.
Sure. And it's that one is a bigger movie. And I think I liked it a smidge more overall than this one. So,
it's
a matter. I know, but it's a matter of taste. I just think that it's a matter of what you feel like going into for a film. And this one just is kind of, it's sad.
It is a downer because it is real.
Yeah, but and again, I'm more of an escapist.
But it's downer with a sweet edge.
It's got a sweet edge, but still, it does not end all that well, no matter how you slice it.
And actually, that's what made it so heavy. The inevitability. You know it's not going to end well. You don't know. They don't foreshadow that too much, but you just know it's coming. When it finally comes, I think it hurts that much more.
Yeah, but I don't really want to be hurt when I go to the movies these days. I know you like that, but...
No, Vice hurt me more than Beale Street.
Vice was more painful to watch than Beale Street. I will give you that. And so there are certainly elements to it that are worth seeing. I don't think it's as good as Moonlighting, though.
Know if I could rank those two.
Yeah, I Moonlight to me was a much more. I was moved a lot more. I remember by watching Moonlight, and so I can still have the visceral memories of that film. And I saw Beale Street a lot more recently. And I did not have that kind of memory of, other than the fact that I remember that we went down to Georgetown to see it and the actors were supposed to be there and then they were a no-show.
Oh, I remember that.
So
we had
so
our
maybe,
guesses why that happened.
Yeah, so maybe that cast a little bit more of a shadow on the whole thing than otherwise would have. But yeah, this is one that's going to have it's going to appeal to the artier audience.
So last week we talked about the consequence of two films opening in the same year that are kind of about the same thing. We talked about Bird Box versus A Quiet Place, both borderline horror films, one you can't talk, one you can't see. Mm-hmm. And there's allusions to Deep Impact and Armageddon and Volcano and Dante's Peak. Well, it happens again, and unfortunately it happens with Ruth Bader Ginsburg this year. I had already seen the one Ruth Bader Ginsburg movie I wanted to see. In fact, I believe it is this year's best documentary film, called RBG, a fascinating portrait of the most beloved Supreme Court justice alive today, and her workout routine. And now there's a fictionalized version of a lot of that film. They focus on the same case, her husband. This time's, I've seen a picture of Martin Ginsburg, and he doesn't necessarily look like Armie Hammer. But we're talking about on the basis of sex, which is probably RBG's most famous cause is gender equality. Mm-hmm. And this is kind of appears to be the case that broke the precedent, that opened the floodgates for her to really pursue her passion and the cause that made her famous and got her on the bench in the first place. Do you agree? I don't know exactly how you feel about this film. Mm-hmm. Do you agree RBG the documentary is a better film than On the Basis of Sex?
No.
Whoa.
Because I actually think they complement each other. Aww. And I think this serves as a perfect film to watch after you've seen RBG, the documentary. I highly recommend you see RBG first, because it then that gives you more of the total trajectory of her life. And then this is taking a slice of her life. It's really her time from law school and the time where she meets her husband Marty, played by Armie Hammer, and it's both a love story and a courtroom drama. So it's a bit On the Basis of Sex is kind of two movies rolled into one. I don't think it's a great movie, but I think it's a good solid movie, and it just is, you know, one of those inspirational films. But I disagree with you. I don't think RBG was a great documentary. It's kind of the same thing as I feel about this film. I love learning more about Ginsburg and her life and what makes her a modern day superhero in real life. But I do not think it was the best documentary. I still think something like Fred Rogers documentary, Won't You Be My Neighbor, was a better documentary overall. And so I thought that the RBG documentary was not the best put together documentary. I liked the subject matter and I was happy to watch it, but I did not find it to be that great of a documentary. And so then going into On the Basis of Sex, I did not find it to be a great movie, but again, a solid movie, an inspirational tale. I love that you have this dynamic. Felicity Jones plays RBG, and Armie Hammer is her like insanely cute and supportive husband. And so I do like the fact that there's that love story part of this film. And so I liked. It's an uplifting film. And so as we talked about all these films that can be downers, it was a real pleasure to see something that just ended. That, you know, it ended in such a way that it just leaves you, one, absolutely rooting for Ruth Bader Ginsburg to stay in the best possible health and alive for as long as possible. And it's just a true testament to just really how smart she is and the path that she took, and that she is such an incredible pioneer. So regardless of whether these RBG and On the Basis of Sex are great, great movies or just good movies, the story of Ruth Bader Ginsburg is a great story.
I think the biggest theme of On the Basis of Sex is that it reminds the audience that not that long ago, 1956, was not a good time to be a woman in the United States. You were supposed to be, by law, a lot of law said, your natural place is at home. Child rearing, nursing. Okay, if you really want to work outside the home, you can be a nurse or a teacher. And it shows Felicity Jones as Ruth on day one of Harvard Law School. Man, she sticks out. She goes to a dinner at the dean's house, played by Sam Waterston. And he says, "Welcome, ladies. There are nine of you. You know, this is like the third or fourth year you've been allowed at Harvard over my judgment. Please stand up, tell us your name, and tell us why you feel you deserve a spot at Harvard over a man. And so it's very stark. It's very jarring for, you know, a lot of people, they still remember 1956. Some of us, you know, some of us, us, you know, just the gender discrimination still takes place today. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. But not to 1956 enshrined in law levels. And this ends in, and I'm fine with it, it ends in a courtroom drama. Mm-hmm. She's standing up, arguing her case, and it fell apart. The movie, right, it just kind of fell apart for me. I thought it was cloying. She was having trouble connecting to judges and other people as a human being. She kind of came across as a robot, as an automaton. And halfway through, she gets this lightning bolt of inspiration on how to connect to people. That did not work for me at all. There are plenty of allusions to the future. You know, there's little inside jokes, little wink winks, nudge nudges about becoming a judge. Justin Theroux's in there as mm-hmm. like the lead lawyer of the ACLU. Stephen Root is another one of the good old boys. Remember, he was Mr. My Stapler, Man in Office Space. And he was also a great character actor this year in The Ballad of Buster Scruggs. I still say, if you have seen RBG, the documentary, there's no need to see the fiction, the fictionalized version.
It's the same territory. It's not. It's in some ways, it's reinforcing a slice of what you got in the RBG documentary. And for saps like me, the romance and that part of the story is...
They skipped it. They were already married when we meet them. They're not falling in love. They're already in love. They're already married and they already have a child. They skipped it.
No, they didn't skip it entirely. It goes back to where they meet in law school.
No, a lot of it shows... Armie Hammer is there as Martin, to show the equality in their household. When you see someone cooking, it's Martin. When you see someone consoling little Jane, the daughter who has a rough relationship with Ruth, it's Martin.
Right, but I mean, I think it's a sweet angle. It adds to the total picture of this woman and how she was able to get to where she got. That if she didn't have the support that she did from her husband. I mean, somebody did ask me, who's raising the kids when all this is going on? Because
apparently it's
nannies. He's got cancer and, you know, and she's juggling his casework and hers. And so it's kind of like, wait a minute, how are these kids getting taken care of? But I did read that Marty kind of came from some money. So chances are that helped tremendously in being able to do what they did. But I do feel that people are going to appreciate that there is this sort of extra layer of a sweet romance that's also part of it. That just shows that there's more to, you know, that there's more to this person, that she's a whole person.
Well, of course there's more to her. But did you notice the writer, Daniel Stiepelman? Is Ruth Bader Ginsburg's nephew. Step back here.
Well,
maybe too close?
Maybe. I mean, it could be. Maybe it would have been a stronger movie if it hadn't had that closeness. But then you had the audacity to point out that Washington Post article today that I did read.
That's my next point. Did it work for you that Kathy Bates showed up in kind of a character that does and does not fit? As a real-life lawyer, Dorothy Kenyon, a generation before Ruth, the first kind of woman lawyer crusader for gender discrimination before it had a name, she shows up as kind of a, this is who was doing it before Ruth. There's kind of a baton handoff between the two. And in real life, they never met.
Well, and that's, I really liked her character, and I think it was a nice homage to her. But it actually was disappointing to me to read that was a manufactured scene, that they had not actually met in real life.
Do you think that's how the courtroom drama went down that day?
No,
you don't think that's manufactured?
No, but courtroom dramas, that kind of those, the way those things play out. Although they do have audio recordings.
Yeah, and so did RBG.
From arguments.
I think they use the same one, in fact.
Right, but so I'm saying that I think that a lot of that is based in fact, that they're able to recreate. They're not going to stray that far from dialogue that actually exists in recordings. So I think they're good companion pieces. I think it's worth seeing both. I think you liked the documentary more than I did. I liked it, but I do feel that there are different things to get from these two movies. And seeing them, if you saw the RBG documentary, I think it's perfectly acceptable all these months later that you go and see On the Basis of Sex as well, especially just to have a feel-good movie. We don't have many just feel-good movies out there anymore.
Bumblebee came out like last week. That
Bumblebee,
feels just
but,
fine.
But a lot of people are not going to go see a movie that has robots fighting in it, no matter what, whether we say that it's a good movie or not. That's just not going to appeal to a lot of people. And I think On the Basis of Sex could appeal to somebody who's just looking for a feel-good movie.
You said Vice was too soon, and it's been 15 years. I think On the Basis of Sex is too soon because I just saw a Ginsberg movie. I just saw it.
But what's going to happen next year when you see the Tom Hanks
too soon.
Mr. Rogers movie?
It's far too soon.
And so
it hurts.
You can make the argument that it's laid the foundation for people wanting to go see this Tom Hanks movie in a year because they got such a good feeling and memory out of seeing Won't You Be My Neighbor, the documentary. So I do think it came out very soon. I would have liked to potentially see this movie about Ruth Bader Ginsburg coming out a little later. I agree that it's too soon, right on the heels, but I'm just saying I don't think it's either or. I think you should watch the RBG documentary, and then if you just want a good, solid, feel-good movie, then On the Basis of Sex is still a really good choice.
Meh.
you got to have some a little bit of the chick flick romantic streak going to appreciate the whole Armie Hammer through line there, because I came out of that movie and
Here's a tweet I saw.
The marketing person was like, "What do you think?" And I'm like, "They got a clone Armie Hammer's character."
tell me your answer to this tweet I saw, which I thought was perfect. Is Armie Hammer a really good actor, or is he just tall?
But you know, maybe I think it worked. Both things work for him. And Marty was tall compared to Ruth.
Everybody's tall compared to Ruth.
And so you see the pictures. Yes, I know. But but oh my gosh, I mean, come on. He could not come off as any more ideal of an ideal partner in life than Armie Hammer is able to portray Marty as. And so half of this movie, the first third of the movie is a bit of a romantic drama. And then the second part of it is it veers then into the courtroom drama. So I don't know. I think there could have been a smoother way to tell that. But I kind of like that both of those pieces were in there.
All right, we're going to circle back and catch up with a movie that actually came out 2 weeks ago. I saw it last weekend with the kid, and I saw it today, in fact. So we're going to catch up with Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. And yeah, talk about a franchise or a character that feels too soon. You know, three Tobey Maguire, two Andrew Garfields. Now Tom Holland had the real Avenger kind of, you know, Spider-Man Homecoming, and then he was in Infinity War. So this one it feels fresh, not only because it really looks like a comic book, but because it's a different kind of Spider-Man superhero. Yes, Peter Parker's in it. In fact, five or six versions of Peter Parker are in it because Big Bad Kingpin built and is running a super collider underneath New York City, and it is bringing in other characters from other dimensions, the multiverse. And that's why it's so because it's so funny. Some of the characters that slide in, some of the other Spider-Men from alternate universes, there's a female, there's a Japanimation one, there's a pig. Spider-Ham is his name.
And my favorite is Spider-Man Noir, voiced by Nicolas Cage.
Absolutely my favorite.
He was awesome.
The reason this is a critical favorite, it will be nominated for Best Animated Film, and I wholeheartedly agree with that, because the hero is fresh. He's Miles Morales. He's a black Spider-Man. He gets bit by the same radioactive spider that the original Peter Parker does, but we've never seen Miles Morales before, and the voice is Shameik Moore. He does all the heavy lifting here. He was in 2015's Dope. I loved that movie. Sundance loved that movie. And yeah, the funniest parts are the other Spider-Men, but there's feeling in here, there's heart, there's empathy. I really loved his uncle, voiced by Mahershala Ali.
Yes, talk about Moonlight.
Nicolas Cage was absolutely my favorite. John Mulaney was funny as Spider-Ham. Thank God they didn't overdo him. Are you as hyped up with Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse as I am.
Not as hyped. I'm sorry. I liked it a lot. It's very imaginative. It's very cool looking. The concept is fresh. I felt that it and somebody immediately rejected my view on this afternoon, that I thought it dragged in the middle. And a friend of mine in New Jersey who saw it was like, no, it didn't drag at all. I loved every minute of it. But I saw it with another female friend, and both of us kind of felt it dragged in around the same point in the middle. The last half hour more than redeems itself. I mean, I loved the last half hour. And I'm absolutely with you on putting it into the mix for best animated. Right now, I would put it probably second. I still think the difference with Incredibles 2 possibly still sort of maintaining a little bit of an edge is because it will appeal to Incredibles 2 is better for younger kids. This one I don't think really works for younger kids. I think it would be actually a little difficult for them to grasp. It's almost a little Deadpool-ish in some aspects of it. I found that the Peter Parker that comes from this other dimension reminded me a lot of Deadpool. And he was very sarcastic and cynical. And so when you look in total at the people that are going to really like this Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, it's going to be the older kids and adults who are really going to like it. But I don't think younger kids, and you can tell me what your younger kid thought.
I was about to say, Hannah, you're right on both counts. First, it is.
I'm sorry, what was that, Charlie?
Well, you're right and you're wrong. I'll tell you why. But it is the second best animated film of the year, behind Isle of Dogs, which is the first one. So you're right about its placement. You're just wrong about what's number
just
one.
Just wrong about one.
Yeah, I took my 5-6-year-old to see it, and he got restless. He was not feeling this movie, and it's because to really understand this movie, to really feel it, you need to know something about Spider-Man. A, you need to have seen all the other Spider-Man films, because they're actually referenced and there's inside jokes to them that I remembered. He's never seen a Spider-Man movie before, so he had half the jokes, boom, gone. The other half are like for 13-year-olds, and I think this is PG-13 maybe. He's just not advanced enough to understand. Like, he doesn't understand why Spider-Man Noir is black and white. He doesn't have a clue. He'd probably want to see more of Spider-Ham, which right. really needs limited screen time. Otherwise, that would be really overdone. He wouldn't understand the Japanimation version
or
Gwen Stacy as being the female Spider-Woman.
Oh, right, we forgot about Gwen Stacy.
He doesn't understand why seeing an African-American Spider-Man is a big deal. He doesn't get that. He doesn't have a clue. Younger kids, yes, will enjoy it because it is animated and there's Spider-Man throwing webs, but they don't get it.
No, and it's too long for the younger kids. I mean, I think that was the problem, is it goes on for close to 2 hours, and that's really long for a cartoon, and it is, in essence, a cartoon. And so I do think that that was one of the issues with that if I got restless in the middle, I can imagine that a lot of younger kids would too. And I almost feel like if it could have just been a really like a perfect 97-minute long movie to me, as opposed to nearly 2 hours. But yeah, younger kids aren't going to appreciate the little homage to Stan Lee that's in there, and some of the inside jokes and some of the things that make Marvel movies Marvel movies. But I think one of the worst things they did was in marketing. I remember seeing like that short. There was a short put out a little while back.
Oh, yeah, we saw that after a movie.
Yeah, and I was not interested at all in seeing this film. And that short did nothing but make me less inclined to see it. And the trailer did nothing to make me want to see this film. What got me to see this film was what everyone who saw it said about it, and the fact that it has like a 97-98% on Rotten Tomatoes, is because it's so much better than the way it was marketed and that the trailer would suggest. Because it was suggested to me, it looked like it was going to be this typical kid cartoon movie, and it's not. It is much more of a animated movie that will appeal to adults and older kids. And so I do think there was some failure in how it's promoted.
It's succeeding despite the marketing. It's making it's making money hand over fist.
By word of mouth.
Yeah, because this is getting around.
It is.
This is great.
And so for the very reason that we do try to catch up on some of these things, I do think for those who haven't seen it and who are on the fence about it, it's kind of worth revisiting because we didn't get to talk about it when it came out. It's still out there, and people are going to see it. And I think a lot of people saw it over the Christmas holiday, and people might want to go try and see it as a family film going into the New Year break.
Well, I want to actually do something weird right now, and I want to talk about a film I haven't seen yet. And I'm going to watch it this week, and I think I'll report back later. And I want to hear from the audience because I want you guys to do this too. You can't do this because you don't have Netflix.
I can watch it here.
It's called, well, I need to watch it on a computer or a tablet or even a phone because it's interactive. I need to go see
I heard about that.
Black Mirror Bandersnatch.
Is now, that a TV series or is it
Black
a movie?
Black Mirror is a TV series. It's episodic. Okay. It's somewhat sci-fi. It's about alternative futures, alternative pasts, it's Twilight Zone-ish, that kind of thing. What makes Black Mirror Bandersnatch so unique is that it's choose your own adventure, with many decisions for the viewers to make as they watch it. Therefore, there's many possible paths for the story to take. As you watch, the episode logs your choices to shape how your reality unfolds. Therefore, there's lots of future rewatching if you are a completist. Uh-huh. There's no official runtime, and it's comprised of many hours of footage.
So yours will be a very bleak portrayal.
mine most likely will be the most depressing thing that could have happened.
I'm sure it will.
But that's why I'm so in on this. I don't know if this is leading edge. I don't think it is. I think it's just, I don't think it's a gimmick.
Either. I don't know.
They did this because Black Mirror has been fighting with things like the Emmy Awards and the Oscars. Like, what is a movie? What is a TV show?
Right.
And so this is kind of like a, you know, kind of an, not an FU, but a, at the various academies. But it's so different that I have to go check this out.
Yeah, we were having a big debate about that just last year at this time about the Netflix films and what counts as a movie and all of that. So maybe that will reignite the debate a bit. I just want to bring up and note another movie that we chose not to see and will not see is Holmes and Watson. And there are so many people that were looking forward to this film, and I am shocked that Will Ferrell and John C. Reilly went and did the whole marketing circuit for this one, because John C. Reilly, for one, has Stan and Ollie coming out in a couple of weeks, and so he's in that one and he's getting, you know, pretty decent reviews for his performance. Not so much in this movie. People who saw these two in Talladega Nights and Step Brothers are going into this expecting it to be as good or at least good enough, but no. From everything I've heard, even if you are a fan of Holmes and Watson, this movie just plain sucks.
Yeah, there's no way I'm going to touch the movie. It's been 0% on the tomato meter forever. I just checked before we recorded this. It's at 7% now. So somebody out there.
Somebody threw him a bone.
I'm going to guess just to be a contrarian, because there are those critics that just want to be a contrarian. Toy Story 3 did get that one negative review. It happens. No, there's no way I'm touching Holmes and Watson at all.
Yeah, and I've put it out there for other people who did see it to tell me what they thought. And so our good listener, Brett in New York, he was very disappointed. I remember his wife telling me that he really was looking forward to seeing this one. And I kind of told her, you know, it's not screening for critics. And when it opens cold, that can be a very bad sign. And sure enough, you know, there are people who are going to go see it because it opens cold and they haven't really heard anything yet. And then they're disappointed. Another friend of mine, his parents went and saw it, thinking they were going to love it. They walked out in the middle of this film, and apparently they're not the only ones.
No, apparently this is getting a lot of walkouts.
Yeah.
But and I think that's all we need to say about Holmes.
Exactly.
All right. Recap of this Christmas movie episode, because most of these opened on December 25th, which is why they've already been out for a few days. Vice, about former Vice President Dick Cheney, absolutely left me cold.
Yeah, skip it, or maybe stream it in 2020.
If Beale Street Could Talk was powerful, moving, and it really solidifies Barry Jenkins as an elite director.
It's a beautiful film, but a downer. So if you just have to be prepared for that.
On the Basis of Sex, I believe, is the fictionalized story of RBG, which is superfluous because there's a perfect documentary out there about her.
And I completely disagree. I think you can see both. I think they're perfectly complementary.
Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse refreshes the superhero film. It's not going anywhere. There's still room to maneuver in this genre.
You liked it a lot more than I did. I just mostly because I prefer live-action superhero films. But I agree. This was a surprisingly intriguing, refreshing take on the Spider-Man franchise. And I really, again, Spider-Man Noir, gotta love that.
You have homework this week, audience. You have to go watch Black Mirror: Bandersnatch. I'm only gonna watch one ending. So you tell me what ending you get. I'll tell you what I get. We'll meet in the middle. We'll see if this experiment works.
Yeah, and I'm actually very curious to find out, too. And maybe I'll just steal somebody's password and do it myself.
You didn't hear that, Netflix.
No,
you didn't hear
no.
that. All right. Well, thank you very much for listening to this episode of The Cinema Clash. I'm Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Yeah, that's right. Happy New Year.
Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah is presented twice each weekend on RadioSt.Pete.com at 5:15 Eastern on Saturday and 9:15 on Sunday mornings. Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. Listen again for Cinema Clash on RadioSt.Pete.com.